Good evening, Zimbabwe. It's 17 hours 20 UTC, 7:20 p.m. in Zimbabwe on Saturday, June 20th, 2015. You are listening to Studio 7 live from the Voice of America in Washington. Thank you for joining us from Washington. This is Gibbs Dube. Here are our top stories this evening. A minister of religion says Zimbabwe is not doing enough to find Occupy Africa Unity Square leader Itai Dzamara.
The government has been strongly suspected to be the one that is doing it, and it's unfortunate, really, to actually have a government suspected to be the one that is doing it instead of the government protecting people.
A cultural center established 7 years ago in Zimbabwe's Matoran South Province to preserve local traditions is attracting a lot of local and international tourists.
We learned about sort of the way that you put mats together, and then we had a fairly long lesson on the setup of the Indabella homestead.
And as usual, we have the Women's Forum with Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahoye. Stay tuned for more details. A minister of religion says Zimbabwe is not doing enough to find Occupy Africa Unity Square leader Itai Dzamara, who was allegedly abducted by unknown assailants recently. Reverend Dr. Ray Motsi of the Baptist Church, who is also president of the Theological College of Zimbabwe, tells Studio 7 the disappearance of Dzamara is very worrying.
This is not anything new in Zimbabwe. We have had people disappear, and unfortunately, quite a number of these people have disappeared, and the government has been strongly suspected to be the one that is doing it, and it's unfortunate, really, to actually have a government suspected to be the one that is doing it instead of the government protecting people. It is very, very unfortunate. That the so-called security of people is actually in danger rather than the national security that we hear. How can we have security when people disappear willy-nilly? And people say they don't know. Our police and our security are so good. There's no way that somebody can disappear within the community and nobody knows nothing about it. That's unbelievable, and that's not true.
Is it not the duty of the state to actually protect citizens?
The security of individuals lies in the hands of the state. Now, when the state folds its hands and they say, we don't know and we can't do anything about it, then there is a problem. And that problem lies squarely in the powers that be.
So now, how best can some of these issues be handled by the government? Because you still remember there was a court order for the government to look for this gentleman and find him. So now, really, what is going on here?
Well, let me tell you what my problem is. I can tell you now there are more than three cases of people disappearing in Zimbabwe, and we are told that the government knows nothing about it. But after 2-3 weeks or months, these people reappear in government custody. And as a result, some of us who are part and parcel of the church leadership in Zimbabwe, we actually find it very difficult to then trust the government and anybody else who purports to be a security person to be helping people, because it seems as if then, therefore, the security is for those that are on their side and anybody else looks after himself or herself.
That was Reverend Dr. Ray Motsi of the Baptist Church, who is also president of the Theological College of Zimbabwe, who was speaking with Studio 7 from Bulawayo. But Maurice Ngwenya, a ZANU-PF activist and political commentator, says such remarks are misleading.
That is a very myopic view and a myopic comment, because people are so ignorant. They don't know that everywhere in the world people can disappear. That happens. And I don't think anyone can argue that the people don't disappear in other places of the world. Perhaps maybe they have an agenda that they are chasing by passing such a comment.
So some of these ministers of religion actually basing their comments on what happened during the Fifth Brigade, and then they cited several other incidents, after independence. What do you think? Maybe you can tell us what you have heard over the years.
It's not only in Zimbabwe. Everywhere in the world, people disappear due to various reasons. If you go to Bedbridge there across the Limpopo, people disappear. If you go into like Wange National Park where there are wild animals, people disappear. If you go in any other place, you find that there are such instances. But this issue, the problem is this issue about Dzamara is a sponsored issue, and people are clamoring because I think clearly there's some sponsorship. There are so many people that have disappeared, but there hasn't been so much publicity like this issue of Zamara.
So now when you look at what you're saying in terms of people being sponsored, who is sponsoring who?
He was working with the NGOs, and he failed to account for the money that he got from the NGOs. And as you know, the NGO have a network. They have a link with the West. Those who are sponsoring the regime change agenda. So it's not a surprise at all.
That was Maurice Ngwenya, a ZANU-PF activist and political commentator, speaking with Studio 7 from Harare. There are several people like state employee Rashiwe Kuja, paralegal activist Paul Chizuze, and other Zimbabweans who have disappeared over the years without trace in the country. A cultural center established 7 years ago in Zimbabwe's Matoran South Province to preserve local traditions is attracting a lot of local and international tourists. Butoleze Nyati of Amakuku International Heritage Center says they are pleased about the large number of people visiting the center, which conducts various activities like mat and basket weaving, traditional food making processes, and others. One of the tourists who recently visited the center, which is designed to represent a local homestead with mud huts, is Jean Marie Jackson, an assistant English professor at Johns Hopkins University in the United States of America.
I mainly teach sub-Saharan African literature at this point. I started off doing South African stuff, and my first book that's coming out is mainly on South Africa. And now my husband and I go between the U.S. and Southern Africa every year. So I'm researching a new project on Zimbabwean literature. And unfortunately, I do not know Ndebele. I only know Shona. But it's on my list of other tasks to get to in the next year or so.
Oh, yes. So now you visited Amakuku Heritage Center. What are the benefits of that kind of center, if you may tell us, from what you gained from your visit?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was really important for me, first of all, because obviously Shona is a more populist culture in Zimbabwe. So I think people who are involved with the country tend to see more things from the Shona side of the situation. So I actually didn't know nearly as much about Ndebele traditions as I did about Shona. So I really enjoyed having a sort of comparative perspective within the country. And I think also when especially kind of Western academics at the moment think about African cultures, it's kind of an Afropolitan, you know, like this sort of hip urban thing right now. And that's important. It's important to think about places like Johannesburg and Nairobi and Lagos. But sometimes what happens from my perspective is that the village or agricultural traditions tend to get lost in that mix. So for me, it was just really interesting to actually see how things are still taking place, you know, right up the road from Bulawayo, practically, and how people are still sustaining themselves through traditional. I mean, we did basket weaving. We learned about sort of the way that you put mats together. We learned about sort of the way that you make and then use traditional costume for different events and occasions. And then we had a fairly long lesson on the setup of the Ndebele homestead and the role that the kitchen plays in that setup.
So with all that you actually experienced in that particular place, do you think it's very beneficial for people to actually visit such centers to learn something, you know, on Ndebele culture or something like that?
I do, very much so, very much so, especially because the people who are working at Amagugu aren't hired to come and pretend that they're, you know, practicing traditional crafts and homestead maintenance. And I think that the big difference between, for example, an American style, we sometimes call them like ethnographic centers or ethnographic museums. I grew up right near one that was all about sort of American farming practices and American craftsmanship and things like that. But there are people who come in and they basically pretend to have these trades in order for you to learn about them. So it's educational, you know, but you're not actually being exposed to the way that other people do things. And at Amagugu, these people are living this every single day of their lives. You know, the founders of Amagugu have been extremely attentive to involving people from the local community. So he said that literally everyone who is participating in it is walking from their home each morning, and they're kind of able to then show you what they would be doing anyway. And then there's a small center where locals can contribute crafts and what they're making, you know, and you can sort of buy and take something away if you choose to.
And how do you find Zimbabwe?
Oh, God, I love Zimbabwe. We're in Cape Town now, visiting family and a lot of close friends here. Both my husband and I have a lot of both personal and research connections in South Africa. And I already miss it. I will go back as soon as I can next May, I imagine. And I think that for me, Zimbabwe is sort of, I don't want to say a hidden gem because that sounds patronizing, but people don't understand the kind of riches that are there, not just for tourists, but for people who want to be immersed in literary and cultural traditions. South Africa tends to loom so large, I think, that Zimbabwe is oftentimes kind of roped into that conversation. And it's, in fact, incredibly distinctive and incredibly rich. And it's a place that I try to get back to as often as I can. And in the meantime, I keep in touch with my language activities through Skype and with people who are living in the diaspora in the D.C. area.
What type of food did you like there?
I cannot stop eating it. I love Saza Ninyama so much. I love budzi, which is buzi in Ndebele. Is that right?
Yes.
I absolutely love it. And it's probably a good thing that I don't live in Zimbabwe full time, because I think I would be about three of the people that I am now from the amount of Saza that I would consume.
That was Jean Mary Jackson, an assistant English professor at John Hopkins University in the United States. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington. We are broadcasting on 909 meter wave and on the 4930, 5940 and 15455 shortwave frequencies. And as usual, it's now time for the Women's Forum.
Welcome to the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women. I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye. Today we have the pleasure of speaking to Chipo Mudzengi Wami, a designer who has made the decision to go back to school as she tries to boost up her credentials so she can go back to doing the job that she loves, which is designing. Welcome to the Women's Forum, Chipo.
Thank you, Margalus.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Chipo Mudzengi Wami?
I'm a fashion designer based in Los Angeles, California, and I'm also a mother and a proud wife.
And how did you get into designing?
I started off designing around 2007, although I was just doing my own styles and I didn't know exactly how to do it professionally, let me put it that way. So I decided to go back to school and I put my business on hold for that time.
When did you come to the United States and how was it to decide to actually go into designing?
I came into the United States in 98 and in 2007, I decided I wanted to start a business. Actually, I had a vision to build a center for single mothers. I have a passion for single moms and I just wanted to give them a platform to be able to get a second chance and take care of their children. So I had a vision to build a center, and I was trying to figure out exactly how I'm going to do that. So I thought to myself, well, you know what? I used to sew when I was younger. So I just started telling my friends and people around me that I sew. And before you knew it, orders were coming in. I was doing fashion shows, even though personally within myself, I did not have that much of a confidence to skip out and really get this done. I decided to go back to school.
Where would you say you drew the confidence from to decide to leave your business and go back to school? Who inspired you?
Basically, I have to say my husband. He encouraged me to go back to school and do the things that I love because, you know, being in diaspora, sometimes it's not ideal to have one person working and the other person going to school or not to work at all. So it was his push, his encouragement that actually inspired me to do what I love and go back to school.
How are you coping being a mother, a wife, and also going back to school and also being the designer that you want to be?
You know, it's very important to have a very strong supportive system. My husband has been supportive from the get-go, and I don't know if I would have done this without him. Our daughter, she's almost a teenager now, but she understands that mommy has to go back to school and get her degree and get things done. So she covers for me, like at home, sometimes cooking when I'm not there, and sometimes taking care of the house, and my husband does groceries. I mean, it's kind of like a team effort to get the certificate, the degrees done.
How can you inspire somebody listening out there, a woman who's also maybe thinking of doing designing or take up a new career path? What's your word of advice?
I would say to a woman who's trying to step out and do that, to just do it. Don't make excuses. We can come up with a million excuses in a day. But I've found out throughout my years that once you set your goal, try to make little steps towards it, even if you can't do it full-time, one day at a time. Think of what can you do during that one day that will get you closer to where you want to be. So write yourself a to-do list, write yourself a goal for the week, what you have to want to have accomplished by that week or by that month. And make it a daily thing, part of your lifestyle, because we put it off. Oftentimes we put it off and we never get to that time when, you know, oh, when I'm done with work, oh, when my baby is grown, oh, when I'm, you know, when I get in a better position. That time never comes. So the time is now. You get it done now.
How much time have you devoted to school, and are you also designing? And if so, which notable celebrities have you designed for?
I'm a full-time student. I go to school from early in the morning. I'm in class by 7 and I come back at 4:30. So school has been my life for the past 3 years, but I also design on my own at home during my spare time. I love creative challenges. Most of the time, I love to challenge my mind. So I create avant-garde stuff, which is not really wearable, but just to, you know, to put my art out there and just show, just do what I love. And as far as designing for any celebrities, I have not gotten to that step yet. I'm hoping that now doors will open and I also have that confidence in me to be able to start designing for people because I now know what I'm doing.
For some other daughters listening out there, what would you advise them to do, especially in the diaspora?
I tell my daughter that she has to take responsibility for who she is. And also that, you know, she has to step up. I know she's young, but, you know, in Zimbabwe, we were never raised to take advantage of people or to expect things to be handed over to us. So I tried to raise my daughter that way and letting her know what the world is like. I'm also doing my college and getting my stuff done. I know that there are eyes looking at me. So that motivates me also to get up in the morning and do my best in class or in my designs, because I want to inspire her. So she sees me bringing the certificates home, being acknowledged in different places, and hopefully it does something positive to her.
Thank you very much, Chipo Mudzengi-Wami, for having been our guest on the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women.
Well, thank you so much, Marvelous, for having me. I really enjoyed this time.
I'm Marvelous Mhlanganya-Huye.
Thanks, Marvelous Mhlanganya-Huye. We hope you are going to have a lovely weekend. And now to recap today's top stories. A minister of religion says Zimbabwe is not doing enough to find Occupy Africa Unity Square leader Itai Zamara, who was recently allegedly abducted by unknown assailants. And a cultural center established 7 years ago in Zimbabwe's Matabeleland South Province to preserve local traditions is attracting a lot of local and international tourists. Now stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele with Chris Gande. This is Gibbs Dube in Washington, D.C., wishing you a pleasant evening and a very, very good night.